The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
When I was first introduced to this practice of Vipassana in Thailand, I spent 2.5 months at a small monastery outside of Bangkok. And at the end of my time there, I asked the abbot, why he had become ordained as a monk. Actually, I think he was ordained first as a novice, as a teenager, and then just stayed and became a monk when he was 20. And my guess is that he would be 55 years old when I met him. So he'd spent, 40 years or so as a monk. And so I asked him, what prompted you to become a monk? And his answer surprised me. And his answer was, surprised me in the way that periodically I've been surprised by some of the teachings I hear from Buddhism, and has caused me to kind of reflect and think more. And his answer, he said, because of the two guardians of the world. To the two guardians of the world. So the guardians of the world, guards the word, protects the world. So there were two protections of the world. And I knew what he meant. I knew enough about Buddhism to know what he meant. But I was still taken aback that anybody would actually say this. And so the two guardians of the world in Buddhism, in the Pali language, they're called Hiri and Otapa. And so the question is, how do we translate these terms into English? In the wonderful gentlemen and gentlewomen who translated the Pali Canon into Victorian English 120 years ago or so, they chose to translate it as shame and moral dread. So maybe you can see why I was a little bit surprised, and my wonderful teacher, I had a lot of respect for, said he became a monk because of shame and moral dread. So I but at the same time, that retreat that I sat with him was also very important for me, because in those 10 weeks of meditating there, I experienced a degree of inner purity or cleanliness that I had been unfamiliar with before. And it became very clear, in a surprising way for me, that this was something that I didn't want to sully, I didn't want to violate somehow, and that certain activities would violate that. So, for example, before I went there, I was living in Japan, and I'd met a lovely Japanese woman who I lusted after. And which was, it was fine. She was single, I was single. And I sat this retreat, and after about 8 weeks or 7-8 weeks of sitting the retreat, I was surprised that I still had fond feelings for her, appreciative feelings for her, but I was incapable of having lust. It just felt like the cleansiness, the purity that I felt inside, somehow would be would somehow agitate, or trouble, or do away with, or cover over the purity that I had. And it just became, at least in the context of the retreat, of sitting there, kind of inconceivable to have that lust that I had just a few weeks before. And that surprised me quite a bit. I had no idea that there could be such an experience, inner experience, that provided a different reference point for my behavior, for my moral behavior. And I hadn't thought that my lust was bad particularly, wrong, but it was, but the contrast was not that I wasn't judging the particular kind of lust that I have as it was bad, but I saw, why would I want to pick that up? You know, I have something much better right now than that. So here the teacher said to me, you know, he was prompted to become a Buddhist monk because of this hiri and otapa. And I think that as I tried to understand this, I understood, one of the ways I understood it was in the reference to something really beautiful inside. That there can be experience of, you know, purity, a word which I didn't like to use for many years because it felt too puritanical and too judgmental, like there was like, you know, too much dividing the world in some ways it shouldn't be divided. But I feel much more at ease now using the word, not because it's meant to be judgmental, but because that there's there can be experiential, immediate sense of something that's quite clean, open, transparent, translucent, pure, perhaps, versus something which is agitated and closed and constricted and agitated, and something feels dirtier and sometimes. And so when we have this kind of reference point to some inner variety of different ways of experiencing ourselves, how does that relate to our actions and what we do? And how does it relate to the consequence of our actions? And I think the suggestion of the Buddhist tradition is that there are two kind of healthy responses that a person can have when there's going to be some kind of harm caused. If we harm someone inappropriately, if we harm someone intentionally to cause hurt, if we hurt someone, then there's an appropriate feeling of regret. And if we don't have that regret, then the world is not protected. People have no regret for their misconduct. We'll just continue doing misconduct. And the world is actually protected from further misconduct by people who feel some regret. Oh, that was, I shouldn't have done that. I think I need to learn from my mistake here. I need to learn from what I did. And so there's some kind of healthy regret that occurs. And that's called the word hiri, which some people will translate as shame. But then what about when you haven't done anything to hurt anybody, but it occurs to you, or the possibility arises that this could happen. And so the possibility or coming into the, close to the territory where maybe you'll do something that causes harm to someone, there's a pulling back from that. No, not that. And that there's a healthy pulling back, and that also protects the world. Because if you're going to lie or steal or kill or something, if that occurs to you and you say, no, not today, you pull back, that protects the world. That's a really good thing. And so that pulling back is a very, very loose way of describing this otapa. And so the otapa is this kind of, and sometimes it's called the fear of wrongdoing or fear of causing harm or fear of transgressing against this inner purity or this beauty or this goodness or something. And it's interesting that the word fear is sometimes associated with it, because perhaps there are healthy fears. There's appropriate fears to have even in a spiritual life, that we can be afraid of the harm we're going to cause. Certainly, hopefully, we feel some fear. I don't want to cause any harm to anybody else. And we can have some fear about its effects on us. You know, I have to live with this for a long time now. So these emotions, these feelings or these emotions, these attitudes, hiri and otapa, can be quite powerful in people. Regret can be quite powerful, so powerful that perhaps regret is not really the appropriate word in English to use for it. Maybe the word shame, or maybe the word guilt, or remorse speaks closer to how deeply we can feel inside our heart ourselves when we've done something that caused harm, done something we feel really, really bad about having done. And there's something I think very healthy about feeling really bad if you've done something really bad. You know, I would suggest that actually that actually is very motivating for us, or can be very motivating, so we can learn and do better in the future. Now, in English, the word shame and the word guilt can have very powerful and deleterious meanings for people. And in fact, in the last year, I've gotten several requests from people to give talks about shame. And I understood that the reason they wanted to was that they had a lot of shame, and it was something they were struggling with quite a bit. When I was younger, I had a lot of guilt. And as I say sometimes, I used to think my middle, Gil was short for guilt. So, I knew a lot about it. And what was marvelous about my guilt is that I could be guilty without having done anything. I was just, born to be guilty. I just felt I was already, I was already doing it wrong, already mistaken, before I even did anything. So it kind of led to a certain degree of, anxiety and, troubles. And what's interesting, one of the very interesting things about these terms, these concepts of guilt and shame, is how they're sometimes intertwined, deeply intertwined, with cultural assumptions about what it means to be a human being and what it means to be a human being in relationship to others. And we shouldn't take it for granted or take it as natural, the views that we've learned from our culture about what it means to be a human being. I think in every culture, if you grow up in only one culture, it's often assumed that this is the way the universe is made. This is the way it is. And what's often not seen is how extremely deeply embedded it is in our psyche, cultural conditioning about what it means to be a human being, what it means to be a human being in relationship to other people. So for example, I'm Norwegian, and Norwegians, like Americans, American kind of, at least, I don't know what to call it, but Anglo-European American culture, has a very strong streak of individualism, independent individualism. And as I was raising my first son, by the time he was about 3 years old, I could see that in the various ways which I was relating to him, I was kind of conditioning him to have the same kind of orientation towards life, that being an individual, being independent were really important. And I could see that my behavior was, because I had value in that. And luckily I could see it. And I've been in other cultures where it's very clear that being an individual, autonomous individual, is not the norm. It's actually, that's not what the culture is teaching. And what the culture there teaches is that who you are is you're a member of a family, you're a member of a society, of an interdependent, interactive community. And so you don't think of yourself as being independent. So, in a individualistic society, if you ask me who I am, I might say I'm Gil. In a communal society, you ask me who I am, and I might say I'm a Franz doll. So one places me in a community, one places me apart from the community, in a sense. And so what's been pointed out is that in some cultures that emphasize being an individual tend to have a lot of guilt, or guilt is a much more important role. That societies that focus on being part of a communal enterprise, shame is a much more important emotion or feeling. It's a little bit, then people analyze why that is, why that difference. And I don't think we should make too much of this, but one difference is that some of it has to do with other things besides this individual society kind of relationship. Some of it has to do with Judeo-Christian ideas of God and why guilt is so deep in the Western psyche, the judgmental God that was maybe internalized over the centuries. But the in a communal society, when you're part of a society, then how other people see you and where you fit into the group as a whole is important. And social control is attained by shaming people and feeling shame. You're concerned about where you fit, your reputation, your face, and you know all you are. And so, some of these communal societies, the most important value is your duty towards others and where you fit into it all. You don't want to lose face. You want to don't lose shame. You don't want to embarrass your group. So shame becomes very important. And in individualistic societies, where shame is not, it doesn't have the same power, because you don't care so much about what other people think of you. But then internal reference points become very much more important. So the internal ideas of right and wrong, so justice becomes very important as a concept. And so people are measuring themselves against standards which are much more absolute. The tendency in communal societies, where you fit in society and the system, is most important. Absolutes are less important. And so it's more important, you know, is it harmonious? Does it create the right harmony in the community? And so there tends to be a little bit more moral, situational morality. How does it fit in creating harmony in communal societies? So shame is important in some kind of cultures, and guilt in others. It's been pointed out by someone that perhaps in our society here in the West that we're going towards a shame culture and away from a guilt culture. That less and less there's absolute standards for our behavior, and more we're controlled by what other people think of us and where we fit into things. I don't know if that's true or not, but perhaps these things shift over the decades and over the generations. So this is a long way of saying that feelings of guilt and shame can be very closely connected to social conditioning, or whatever we have, and comes together with how, in some deep way, we see who we are. And so some of the problematic ways in which people feel shame or guilt have to do with a global judgment about who they are as a person. So I'm guilty. I'm a bad person. You know, I'm a shameful person. So I am guilty, as opposed to I'm guilty of that act. And there's a world of difference between saying I'm guilty versus I'm guilty of that act. One is to say I'm guilty defines us as a person. I'm guilty of an act focuses more on the action itself. And so some of the ways that people suffer a lot around guilt and shame is when somehow or other they've internalized some kind of global interpretation definition of who they are, and they define themselves by these two concepts and ideas. And these weigh people down, some people dramatically. Some people walk around with it. Some people, the sense of shame or guilt has been somehow very deep, kind of painful forms of it, are learned sometimes very early in life. Sometimes children who have very difficult time understanding what's going on in their life and why things happen will internalize these things and kind of define who they are. I'll give you a small example. When I was, I think I was six, it was 4th of July, and we lived in this apartment block complex, and we had this backyard that we shared with all these neighbors, and there was this 4th of July party, and we had this little picket fence in the back somehow, and this and early in the day I'd found a long pole, I don't know how big it was, but a long pole, and I had dragged it to the back of our yard, and some stranger I didn't know, or some neighbor nearby, found the pole. And then he used the pole to try to pole vault over that fence. And in the process of doing that, he broke his leg. So you know who was responsible, right? I. It was my fault. Because I brought that pull over. So I had no sense of causality, but I was convinced that I was wrong. That I was bad in some way. So that, you know, and there's lots of things that can happen to children where somehow they internalize, this is who we are. I remember when I was, I've told this story sometimes, when I was in seventh grade, I was drawing my hand in art class. And now my hand, like most of your hands, I think, has a lot of lines in it. A lot of lines. And so I was going to do a realistic drawing of my hand. So I started drawing in all the lines I could see. And after a while, the teacher came over and said to me in the most matter-of-fact voice, Gil, you have no artistic ability. Now, I didn't really, you know, it never occurred to me that I should even want to have artistic ability. And I had no ambition about artistic ability. It was fine with me not to have artistic ability. But here, this authority walked up to me and said, you have no artistic ability. So that became part of my identity. That's who I am, you know. I didn't mind, just that I carried that with me for the next 6 years. You know, that's, you know, turned out that was wrong. But it's for 6 years I believed it. Children who have traumatic things happen to them sometimes will internalize the feeling of shame, like sexual abuse will internalize that I'm a shameful person, I'm a bad person. There's many reasons for it, that we kind of take a global picture, this is who I am. And I think it causes a lot of unnecessary harm. The Buddhist idea of hiri, sometimes translated as shame, I'd like to translate as regret, is that I prefer regret because regret focuses on actions. We regret a particular action, whereas shame can easily morph into something more global. And I think it's very healthy to feel regret. And the same thing about the otapa, which is a fear of wrongdoing, or conscience sometimes it's been translated. It's Tanisara Bhikkhu translates this, monk I know translates it as compunction. But I have to ask him, what's compunction? What's that mean? And he said, oh, it's the English way of using the word. Thanks. Apparently, English in America, they use the word compunction differently. Apparently, in English, in American English, it means compunction. Anybody know? It means like that you have this compulsion to do something, maybe?
No.
What? Yeah, that's what he said was the English understanding, the English. American English, too? Good. So it's a great, I learned a new word, compunction. But I don't know if we want to use these, for me, obscure word. Maybe for you, some of you, you're familiar with it. I'm still struggling with the English language. So this fear of wrongdoing. But again, you know, maybe it has to focus more on actions. And this is what I've seen in Buddhism. Buddhism focuses a lot on the actions rather than the global definitions of who we are. And in the West here, for example, where we have some global understandings of a person, you know, like original sin creates a global understanding of what a human being is. And then in contrast to that, some Buddhists or Western Buddhists will say, well, Buddhism doesn't teach original sin, it basically teaches original goodness, which is also a global view. But in fact, the Buddha didn't have a global view of a human person that way. He was much more immediate, here and now, in a sense, about the actions that we have done, we are doing, and that we will do. And we look at it, we look at our life through the viewpoint of actions and behavior rather than interpretations. And so what is the consequence of the actions we've done? What is the consequence of the actions we're doing? And what are the consequences of the actions we've done? And to look at that and take that into account and learn from that. And then learning from that is very important because I think we all make mistakes. We do things perhaps that cause harm. You know, we've probably done it at some point in our life. And it's easy to feel some regret. It's also easy to feel guilt. And the reason why it's sometimes said that in Buddhism there's no guilt is that that's said when guilt is defined as a global form of self-aversion. If that's what it means, then there's no guilt in Buddhism. But if guilt means feeling bad or feeling like, yes, in fact, I did an action which was wrong to do, if that's what guilt is, then there is guilt in Buddhism. But it's the action that's Buddhist focus on. But also, what Buddhist analysis of all these things is not backward-looking in order to dwell and suffer because of the past, but it's rather backward-looking just enough, so that we can learn to do better in the future. So Buddhist ethics tends to be more forward-looking than backward-looking. We can't ignore the past. It's very important not to ignore what happened in the past. We want to learn from it, but we don't want to linger in the past and suffer unduly because of the past. It's much better to take what we've done and learn from it, and then try to do better in the future. And so these guardians of the world, regret and fear of wrongdoing, are part of the mechanism, gives part of the motivation and strength to that relearning, to that analysis and that attempt to try to live a better life, a cleaner life, a purer life, a more helpful life. Finally, I'd like to say that the standard by which this the hiri notappa arise is related to whether harm is being caused. Not by some other kind of standard, ethical standard. It's not like, I don't know what, but I mean, there's a variety of standards people can measure people against. For example, you know, there's a lot of discussion about gender orientation. Some gender orientations are supposed to be good, some wrong. Who knows which ones or what? But some people think they know. And Buddhism doesn't measure people by gender orientation, ethically. Gender orientation, I mean, sexual orientation is what, you know, fine for what it is. But is there harm or is there not? That's the measure over and over again. And what's interesting about harm is that our relationship to sensing and feeling harm is more than just an ethical analysis. It's not just an intellectual idea. But I would suggest it's something visceral, something we can feel empathically, immediately. And so the feelings of hiri and otapa, this regret and this fear of causing harm, belongs not so much to our intellect, but really belongs much more to our heart. It's an aspect of the heart which is open, sensitive, aware, connected to ourselves and to others. Then I think there's almost like a natural instinct to feel regret when we've done harm, almost a natural instinct to pull back and not want to go some places. And so the last thing that I'll say is that in relationship to all this, shame and moral dread, is the Buddha came out of a family, a caste in ancient India that belonged to the warrior caste. He was a warrior. He was trained supposedly to be a warrior. And in the old days, and in a lot of cultures, there was nobility or dignity or a strong degree of self-respect that went into being a warrior. And a warrior doesn't do something that diminishes his or her self-respect, because self-respect is something that's of high value. And so perhaps the Buddha was raised with this idea, we don't know for sure, but I kind of like to think that way, that these very strong and very powerful guardians of the world are not here to diminish us, not here to shame us, but rather are here, or are pointing, these teachings are pointing to a very deep sense of self-respect or dignity that we can carry with us as we walk through the world. that is because of the tremendous self-respect we can maybe feel for ourselves, tremendous worth we have for ourselves, love we have for ourselves, that this regret and this fear of wrongdoing gets its strength. Does that make sense? So now we have 10 minutes or so, 11 minutes. So now I'd like to hear from you. I'd like to hear comments, protests, regrets, fears, questions, anything you'd like to say. Yes, please. But if you could wait for the mic, please.
Could you speak maybe about the guilt or regret of not doing certain actions, or maybe clarify harm a little bit more, especially in the age of interconnectedness and global warming and species depletion, things like that?
Well, I think the lack of action sometimes can cause harm as well. And so, but one of the interesting questions when you bring it to the level of the global question is what level of responsibility do we have, and what motivates our actions? So, it's interesting that back when I went into college, there was this idea of the tragedy of the commons. Maybe you know this idea. You know, the first person who drove a car, you know, it didn't really cause any problem with air pollution. In fact, in New York City, before there were cars, the problem was manure pollution. It was a big problem in New York City. All these horse and buggies and horses. And when they substituted cars for horses, it kind of actually cleaned out the air in New York City. But then, you know, that was fine for the first, I don't know how many, first million cars. The atmosphere can handle it. At some point, we come to a tipping point where the commons, the air we breathe, it wasn't sustainable to have the number of cars we have. So at what point does it become unethical to continue driving a car? You know, because the first million wasn't unethical, perhaps, or the first 10, I don't know how many. But at some point, it gets a tipping point where actually it causes harm. So then what do we do about that? How do we relate to that kind of issue? If we don't do anything, I suppose then we're not even driving a car to begin with, right? But if we don't do anything and continue driving our car, then we are doing something. So I think there can be some feeling of regret. And I drive a car. I feel regret for driving my car. And it becomes a complicated and somewhat intuitive calculation in my mind about whether it's worth driving my car or not. I don't know if I make the right choice. I don't feel necessarily good about the choice I've made, but I have made the choice to drive a car, given the balance of things. And I try to do it mindfully and carefully. But now I'm going on and on. Do you want to ask again, more specifics? You're concerned? That's good enough? I don't think so. No, I just want to go, you know, I'm interested in the topic, so I just wanted to kind of...
I think that's what I was looking for, the idea of being mindful about your choices and understanding that there are risks and harms involved.
Definitely. And I think it's very important to understand. That's why a certain degree of education is important, because it's important to understand the consequences of our actions that are unseen. Much of what we do, we send out to the garbage one way or the other, and we don't care where it goes, many of us. And it's quite something to actually follow your garbage to where it goes and then say, wait, do I really want to live a life that does that? Nowadays people are much more conscious than they were 20 years ago about the water that goes into the bay. And it used to be you put your oil down into the drain. And now they realize the oil, it's pesticides or whatever, goes out into the bay and causes harm there. But it takes some education to learn that. And so it takes, my feeling is that we have a responsibility to educate ourselves a little bit and not just sit passively thinking, well, I'm not doing anything wrong. But, you know, if we're going to use all this stuff, I think we should try to learn more about where it comes from and where it goes, so we know what our consumption is, be responsible for our consumption.
Okay, I'm going to throw my question in really quick. I'm not exactly sure if I'm going to put this in the right terms, but for the sense of shame, and it was moral judgment, right? Was the second?
No. Well, the Victorian way was moral dread.
Moral dread. Okay.
But I would like to call it fear of wrongdoing.
Okay. So
those, kind of in a healthy fear.
Okay. Those two concepts, in whatever definition that they are, how was it interpreted that that would influence then our actions or desire to be amongst others and maybe to serve others? Like, I know you were talking about how in being more mindful of that and recognizing how our actions would possibly harm or do good, that we would hopefully choose to be doing better and to be more helpful to others. But where does that sort of go in as far as serving others or trying to make sort of more of a positive difference maybe in the world, versus, I know there's a lot of talk about turning inward and focusing on how we're...
Well, that's a good question. I think that we shouldn't underestimate how helpful it is to others that we don't cause any harm. You know, just that, it's pretty good. You know, it's amazing, you know. And it's, and one of the great gifts we can give is the gift of safety. People feel safe with us. But the but I don't think it goes much further than that. These particular emotions, for in order to actually act more actively for the benefit of others, I think compassion is much more motivating, much more important. So these two have much to do with avoiding harm. And then, if there harm has been done, to remedy it, because remedies are needed sometimes. Confession, for example, can be a remedy. You know, atonement, or you know, doing something. So they're more on that side of it. That's okay. Abraham.
It can sound really harsh to have moral dread and shame.
That's why I tried to use different words, regret.
Yeah.
And fear of wrongdoing.
Yeah.
Because of the harshness, because of how many people in our culture hear these words, shame and guilt and moral dread, and it kind of resonates with that conditioning. That harsh, difficult conditioning they've received about this global interpretations, I'm wrong, I'm bad. And so I thought it was very important to distinguish between those two. But please ask your question.
But, yeah, and for me, I think it can also be helpful to go at it the other way, which is like, you know, I'm at work and I need some envelopes at home for my personal business, but... and there's all these envelopes at work, and I really don't have time to go to the store on the way home because I got a lot to do tonight. So I think I should just take a whole bunch of envelopes because they're not really going to miss them. So a small issue, but to look at it in terms of, you know, to do no wrong, to take nothing that hasn't been freely offered, can help to educate me in terms of how I act every day.
Yes,
you know?
Absolutely. So I agree with you. There's no question there, but if I may piggyback on that, say something I meant to say but didn't come up in my talk. I think it's very interesting that maybe I shouldn't say for everyone, at least for me, I found it very interesting to watch myself and to notice how my ethical sensitivity, my ethical standards, or my ethical my ethics can vary depending on how strong my practice is. That's how I call it for myself. But so if I'm my mindfulness is strong, my calm is strong, I feel very much connected to myself, relaxed, then I'm much more ethical. If I'm harried, upset, angry, in a hurry, you know, it's really easy to do something with my middle finger. It's really easy to do something with my middle finger. But, you know, I wouldn't dream of doing that, you know, when I'm settled and relaxed and, you know, just wouldn't arise, you know. And so I could see in myself that, you know, when I'm much more centered and I've meditated and, you know, connected someplace, it's interesting to watch it shift and change. And so you would think that our ethics is something which is, you know, based on some ethical standards, you know, some rules and regulations, you would think, well, then it just, you know, it's either or. But I think a lot of it has to do with not the either or rules, but rather how connected we are. At least I find that for me. And so I'm much more interested in how the mindfulness practice, meditation practice, spiritual practice can, in a beautiful way, help us to feel connected to a source inside of us, or a sensibility or an intelligence inside of us, which informs what kind of behavior that seems appropriate and inappropriate. And it's not external standards of right and wrong, but rather this inner standard of just kind of what feels good. And so then it being ethical, it's not just a matter of what we do, but I would say much more important than what we do, being ethical depends on how we cultivated ourselves, what level of responsibility we've taken for cultivating an inner, you know, spiritual life or inner life that would naturally be ethical. So my hope is for all of you who do meditation practice regularly, my hope is that meditation practice, Buddhist spiritual practice, will in its own way help you touch into a moral guide, an ethical guide that resides in your heart, and that you'll just feel your sense, that inner purity or cleanliness or that inner sense of rightness or harmony or whatever you want to call it, and that'll be your guide. And the more you're in touch with that deep inside, less and less you'll be capable of doing something unethical or doing something which causes harm intentionally. So I hope that was okay to hear all that. I hope it wasn't too much like a fire and brimstone talk. Shame and moral dread. And I offer that talk to all of you with tremendous respect for each and every one of you. Thank you.